All right, all the giant telecommunications companies that want to merge take one step forward. Hey, you there, Comcast and Time Warner, not so fast. A deal likely comes undone. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 23rd of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We're going to put the caveat right up top as we get going today. There has been a firm no comment to us from Time Warner Cable about what I'm going to say next, but there are reports this afternoon, not just one, not just two, not just three, but four and counting, that Comcast is going to walk away from its proposed $45 billion takeover of Time Warner Cable. Rumors of the deal's demise have been circulating all week long. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has more on why and what happens now.
No industry scores lower on the American Customer Satisfaction Index than the cable companies. Within that industry, no company scores lower than Comcast, except Time Warner. But emeritus law professor Peter Karstensen says the problem for this deal wasn't so much about less competition resulting in worse service for customers.
These two companies do not compete directly for cable subscribers or internet subscribers.
At my Brooklyn apartment, I can only get Time Warner, whereas over in Newark, I might only get Comcast. Where these companies do compete is in buying programming, like cable channels.
When I teach Buyer Power, I usually talk about the impact on farmers of having only one meatpacking facility. You don't have a choice about where to sell your cattle.
In this analogy, the merger would have created a huge meatpacker, and the farmers forced to accept bad deals for their cows, that would be the TV networks. Here's Senator Al Franken.
I've had content providers, I'm talking about networks, come to me and say they're against this, but they're afraid to say anything because they fear retribution.
Those networks may be celebrating today, but analyst Ian Olgerson says consolidation is still likely in Time Warner's future.
It could be Charter, it could be Time Warner Cable buying somebody else. So there's a lot of different computations that could potentially emerge following the collapse of this.
But he thinks the results of any of these mergers for the customers consuming all the internet and TV content are likely to be subtle. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio wants to lift 800,000 New Yorkers out of poverty over the next decade. It's a plan called One NYC. The details run 332 pages, by which I guess I mean some of the details. Left out was just, for instance, how to pay for it. But one of the tentpoles of the thing is affordable housing, something that many cities, and not just New York, are sorely in need of. So we asked Marketplace's Noel King to find out the answer to this question. What would affordable housing for all, or at least most New Yorkers, look like?
A new mixed-income tower is opening on Manhattan's Upper West Side, and there's a lottery for the low-priced rental apartments. Around 90,000 people applied for 55 units. You'd have better odds buying a winning New York lottery ticket. Nicholas Bloom is a professor at the New York Institute of Technology and co-editor of Affordable Housing in New York. He says to ensure every New Yorker has an affordable place to live,
you would have to build on a heroic scale. You would have to build enormous developments with thousands of units each, all of them basically below market at some level.
One option is building up.
That particular vision would look more like an Asian city, somewhere like Hong Kong or Singapore, where, for instance, the government does play a major role intervening in the housing market.
So how do you do that? Here's Benjamin Dolchin of the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. He says make developers who take advantage of tax breaks build mixed-income housing.
Even purely private developments in New York City get some kind of meaningful public support, either through tax policy or through zoning policy. Those developments will have some affordable housing in them as part of the trade-off of the public support they get.
De Blasio plans to build or preserve 200,000 affordable units over 10 years. But that's not all, says Mark Willis, the executive director of the NYU Furman Center.
Interestingly enough, in the de Blasio plan is now also 16,000 units a year, 160,000 over the 10 years for off-market rate housing.
An acknowledgement, Willis says, that everyone in New York, not just lower-income people, is experiencing the effects of a housing shortage. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, back to the future, you might say. The Nasdaq topped its record high set back in the days of the dot-com bubble. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, on the list of states hardest hit by the Great Recession, the usual suspects: Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, also Rhode Island. Same thing for economic recovery. If you look at the charts and the data, Rhode Island is right down near the bottom. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson took a trip to figure out why and what it's going to take to set things right.
When she was younger, Carolyn Rafalian used to have to work at her dad's jewelry factory as punishment if she was bad. Now she and her sister run it.
Smell that smell? That's factory smell. I get excited when I smell that smell when I go inside the factory.
Her dad started this factory in 1966. Believe it or not, Rhode Island used to be a global capital of jewelry manufacturing. During the 1980s, it produced an estimated 80% of the costume jewelry made in the U.S. Much of that business has now moved overseas, but not Carolyn.
This is what I'm talking about. This is what you can't find in China or any place else in the world. Archives of stones. It's the sizes, the shapes, it's all in the settings. They don't even make this stuff anymore.
Waist-high cabinets line one end of the factory, their drawers filled with beads, some yellow and orange like candy corns, some pink as grapefruit. At the other end, women sit at long tables, each working on a different task.
Within minutes, you're creating a finished piece. You know, you can't do that anywhere else.
But in the late 90s and early 2000s, business was tough. So instead of selling to wholesalers who'd sell to stores like her father had, Carolyn launched her own line of jewelry called Alex and Ani. She specializes in thin metal bangles with charms. By 2009, the factory was making Alex and Ani products exclusively. In 2013, annual revenue hit $230 million.
And I took it somewhere else, but it's all still part of what this place represents. And there's machines that could probably do this automatic, but that would probably take away 15 jobs, 20 jobs. I like it this way. Every piece is being touched.
Carolyn insists she can't make her products in China. That part of their appeal is that made in Rhode Island story. But where she's thrived, lots of others have folded.
Rhode Island's manufacturing sector has essentially been cut in half in the past couple of decades. We lost more than 80,000 manufacturing jobs.
Gina Raimondo is Rhode Island's governor. She's just a couple months into the gig and very, very aware of the big structural problems her state's economy faces. Like Carolyn, her dad also worked in the jewelry industry.
You know, my father made his career at the old Bulova watch factory in Providence. At one time, Bulova employed over 1,000 people. Those jobs are not coming back. My dad's manufacturing, that is gone, and I don't see that coming back to America, much less Rhode Island.
The jewelry and textiles and other labor-intensive stuff that Rhode Island historically made was more vulnerable to competition from China than other states, says Mary Burke. She's an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. By the 2000s,
the manufacturing sector was doing very poorly. And in a lot of ways, that was hidden by the housing boom, because the housing boom was creating jobs in construction as well as in retail. It was boosting spending and a lot of other things.
Until the housing bust and subsequent recession. Then the state started earning the wrong kind of superlatives. Its job losses were the worst in the region, and it's still furthest from its pre-recession peak. It had the highest unemployment rate in the country for parts of 2013 and 2014. But the state's economy is gradually recovering.
It's not going to happen overnight.
Here's Governor Raimondo again.
The decline has been over decades, and it's going to take time to turn the ship.
She recently proposed an everything but the kitchen sink jobs plan. Initiatives ranging from tax incentives to a new tourism campaign. And she wants manufacturing to play a role in the state's future, but high-tech manufacturing with better-paying jobs. Jobs she knows Rhode Island residents may not currently have the skills to do. So also in that plan, training programs, both for the jobs the state already has and the ones it hopes to create. In Rhode Island, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Capitalism works in curious ways sometimes. I think I've said that every now and then on this program. Today's example is brought to us by a bug. It's a beetle, technically, the mountain pine beetle. It is a tiny yet ravenous little creature that over the past 15 or so years has eaten its way through and thus killed more than 40 million acres of forest in this country. To clean up all that dead wood, land managers have turned to the timber industry, which has meant jobs and livelihoods. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, the bugs have almost eaten themselves out of food and the people out of work.
Hank Lucido looks just like a lumberjack out of a fairy tale. The big burly beard, the stocking cap, the boisterous laugh.
This is a log loader, and obviously he's loading logs. And then he'll pile brush with it like he did over there.
Today, the company he manages, West Range Reclamations, is harvesting beetle-killed ponderosa pines on the Colorado-Wyoming border.
Hey!
Lucido gives a holler, and the log loader's giant metal claw starts grabbing up several logs at a time and stacking them on a logging truck to ship for processing. And boy, do they use it all, even smaller branches and rotting logs.
With a lot of our byproduct, we grind up and we make the colored bark mulch. Then there's other places such as dairies and horse barns that like to have wood shavings. We sell that product too.
And they supply wood for products never before manufactured in the region, like pellets for heating stoves and biofuel for the energy grid. Wyoming increased the number of timber industry jobs by 25% in the last 10 years, adding some 5,000 new jobs industry-wide. But Lucido says all this work could soon come to an end. That's because the quality of the wood available to the industry is deteriorating fast. The pine beetle has killed all its best host trees, and what's left is rotting from the inside out. Standing next to a pile of wood, Lucido jabs his finger into the pulpy center of one log.
Some of this stuff, when it gets this red rot to it, if we were to grind that, it would turn to dust. You know, when we go to grab it and it crumbles, then it's not worth anything to us.
And it's not worth anything to other businesses that depend on the lumber from pines either, like Rich Arbers. He manufactures rustic furniture and sells it in his store, Mountain Woods, in Laramie, Wyoming. He used to sell lots of dining tables and bunk beds made from bluestain, a unique-looking wood made from beetle-killed trees. But now...
I only have one,
and it's a particularly nice piece.
And that's this entertainment center here.
He points at the streaks of reds and blues on the cabinet's door.
The beetles have infested the wood. The tree is trying to preserve itself, and it's emitting enzymes. And the enzymes are what makes that color in the wood. But it makes for pretty woods.
He says when the pine beetle was a big deal in the news, people couldn't get enough of blue-stained furniture. But with the epidemic on the decline...
The interest in it has waned in a big way.
And will likely continue to wane as the forest turns green again. And timber manager Mark Westfall says the U.S. Forest Service will likely manage that next generation of young trees with a tight fist until they're mature enough to harvest.
How long we'll be offering traditional timber sales, that's kind of to be seen. Really depends on how long the trees continue to stand.
Westfall is the guy issuing the Forest Service contracts to loggers like Hank Lucido. But with fewer and fewer trees left, Westfall says they'll have to start weighing the health of the timber industry against the health of the forest. Logger Lucido says the timber industry is running out of time to harvest what's left.
If we don't get into this wood in the next 5 years, it's going to either be blown over or burned up. And once it falls onto the ground, it's done.
But Lucido says when the pine beetle boom is over, he trusts the timber industry will still have a role to play, managing a healthier forest less prone to such epidemics in the future. In Laramie, Wyoming, I'm Melody Edwards for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Hotels have record occupancy rates, and a lot of people we launched thought we couldn't coexist, but we are fundamentally a different way to travel.
Yeah, if you don't mind staying in somebody else's house. The CEO of Airbnb straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 20 points today, 10%, closed at 18,058. The NASDAQ up 20 points, 0.4%, finished at 5,056. As I said, topped the record high from the dot-com days 15 long, long years ago. The S&P 500 added 4 points, 0.2%, 2112 there. General Motors slid 3% after missing its profit mark. Consumer giant Procter & Gamble off 1.8%. Today, both companies reported weaker than expected earnings due to a stronger dollar. Ahead of the release of its smartwatch tomorrow, Apple clicked up 0.8%. Google clicked up 1.5%. Today, by the way, is the 10th anniversary of YouTube, the company that Google acquired back in 2006. So, yeah, you know, make yourself feel better. Go watch a cat video. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for March. NASA's New Horizons spacecraft is getting closer to Pluto, where it will snap close-ups. Want to name one of the surface features of the dwarf planet? The public has until tomorrow to submit suggestions. And back on Earth, it's National Arbor Day. Snap a selfie with the tree of your choice. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know how when there's a big bill being considered in Congress, the whole thing, no matter how many thousands of pages the legislation in question runs, the whole thing always boils down to just a couple of key issues. Same thing's happening right now with the trade deal known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Both the House and Senate are considering what's called fast-track authority for President Obama, lets him negotiate and limits Congress to just an up or down vote on the thing. But that does not mean, despite what you might think, smooth sailing ahead. There is still plenty of opposition to the deal, opposition that seems to be coming together around the issue of currency manipulation. Marketplace's Adam Allington has more on what exactly that means and why it matters.
Generally speaking, a country with a weaker currency is thought to have an advantage in trade because their stuff is cheaper. So currency manipulation is when a central bank buys or sells foreign currency in an attempt to influence the exchange rate. In practice, however, Carl Weinberg with the firm High Frequency Economics says the threat posed by this tends to be overstated.
Quite frankly, domestic monetary policy usually has more important things to do to help the economy than to focus on trade.
While some countries such as Japan and South Korea may dabble in this area, Weinberg says the broader impacts of the Pacific trade deal outweigh the risk.
The trade treaty has values and merits of its own, independent of anything that's happening on the currency side.
The Treasury Department already has some oversight in this area, which currency analyst Mark Chandler says is an authority it rarely uses, even though some members of Congress think it should.
The U.S. Treasury has not cited any country of currency market manipulation for over a decade.
Free trade agreements tend to be controversial, and Chandler points out that if the Pacific deal does go through, together with NAFTA, roughly 40% of world GDP will be subject to free trade. And if it doesn't,
it would look like the U.S. is retreating from the global international leadership space.
China, the country most often accused of manipulation, isn't part of the deal, and the yuan has actually been gaining against the euro and the dollar for some time. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
If you're traveling this summer, maybe someplace here in the United States or maybe overseas, you're probably looking for a place to stay. One of the options is staying in somebody else's house or apartment or yurt or treehouse, in point of fact. Airbnb has all kinds of options, and it's arguably the prime example of what has come to be called the sharing economy. So I went up to San Francisco last week for today's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Brian Chesky is one of Airbnb's three co-founders. The company's been around for about 7 years. It's valued at about $20 billion. And as seems to so often happen with tech companies these days, it started in somebody's apartment. In this case, Brian Chesky's apartment, which is where, in a way, he and I started talking.
So we're in a meeting room, and we modeled our meeting rooms after listings and homes on our website. Right. And this is the very first Airbnb ever. This is the model of it, which is the apartment that Joe and I still live in. It was in 2007, we had this idea to rent out this apartment. Actually, it was more like a problem than idea. We couldn't actually pay rent. Right. And so we had this idea, what if we turned our home into a bed and breakfast for the conference? Joe pulled out some airbeds. We called it the Air Bed and Breakfast. This is listing number one.
Excellent. All right, let's go look at a couple more, and then we'll come talk.
Behind us is Bali. In front of us is Milan.
How do you overcome the, I don't know if I want to stay in somebody's house, you know?
People call this the worst idea ever. This may very well be the worst idea that ever worked. It just seemed like this for like a couple years was just a terrible idea and no one would do it. So I think our core invention
is the idea of a reputation system.
So what are you guys then? Are you a tech company? Are you a hospitality company? Are you a social media-ish company?
You know, it's hard to put yourself in one box, but I think I define the company as whatever the customer or the person's buying. I think our guests are buying hospitality. Now, I don't think of the hospitality company the way these 100-year-old companies are. In those ways, we look and feel a lot like a technology company. But I think we are a hospitality company powered by design and technology.
Who's your competition then? Is it, because it's not Marriott and you know, the Four Seasons, right?
I think we're primarily creating a new travel segment. And you know, as we've grown, hotels have also grown. Hotels have record occupancy rates. And a lot of people we launched thought we couldn't coexist. But we are fundamentally a different way to travel. Now we're one of the official housing providers for the Rio Olympics next year. So I think there's indicators that it's starting to go mainstream.
Or you're becoming the establishment. If you're an official housing provider of the Olympics.
One of them, yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Like you guys and UPS and McDonald's and Coca-Cola.
I think that the difference between us and maybe McDonald's and UPS is that we are truly a community of people. And so while the platform could get more established, the people we represent are primarily the underdogs. You know, this is a company that was rooted in a couple people that couldn't afford to make rent. And around the world, you have hundreds of thousands of people that depend on Airbnb to pay their rent, to pay their mortgage, to get by, and maybe for the first time feel like they can be an entrepreneur as well.
Regulators, housing regulators, and fair housing advocates, and low-income advocates, they don't necessarily love you. They say you go into a city, you take housing supply inventory off the table, you jack up rents.
Yeah.
Are you sympathetic to that? I mean, I get it's your business model, but are you sympathetic to the complaints?
I'm totally sympathetic to the complaints. I mean, ultimately, we want to enrich the cities we're in. When you launch, these other externalities happen that you weren't predicting. That being said, I fundamentally do believe that Airbnb is a really good thing for the city of San Francisco, New York, many other cities. We're in 34,000 cities. Now, some of these advocates are complaining that we're raising rents. We've actually done studies. Those studies say that we either are not raising rents or it's completely de minimis. What we're doing in the process is providing thousands of people to stay in their homes. So I do think we're on the right side of affordable housing.
And yet in your largest market, New York City, your business model is basically illegal.
Well, that's actually definitely not true. You're allowed to – a lot of activity is legal. There is activity that falls under a gray area. They say it's not legal, but it's definitely not true that it's all illegal. We've been working with the city, and we are on a path to trying to legalize Airbnb in New York. You know, city of San Francisco has legalized Airbnb in February. So city by city, we're trying to modernize and get to a path of recognition. The fact that even the city of New York says, we want Airbnb here. Some people have some issues with some of the activity going on, but I don't think anyone would say they don't want us there.
One of the problems cities have with you is that Airbnb folks don't generally pay taxes. Would you be willing to explore that as a way to get yourself into the good graces of, say, New York City or Los Angeles?
Well, we're actually collecting and remitting taxes here in San Francisco on behalf of our hosts, which is something the law doesn't even require of us. And I see us doing this more and more. It requires you to actually partner with the city. You can't just send them a briefcase of money. You have to actually work with the treasury or finance departments of the city. We are now collecting and remitting, I think, $1 million a month just here in San Francisco.
You're 33-ish years old?
33, 34.
You're running a giant, successful global company. You're worth a whole lot of money. How much longer does this maintain your interest?
There are a few entrepreneurs that I admire. Walt Disney is one of my favorites. Steve Jobs. I think really great entrepreneurs, they do one thing. And that one thing is so significant that that's how they're remembered and that's what they do for a very long period of time. You know, Disney did many things at Disney. I think I can do many things at Airbnb. And I admire all these entrepreneurs, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, we're all in that school of like, just pick one thing and just do it.
You're putting yourself in some pretty good company there. Bezos and Zuckerberg and Disney and Jobs.
They're like my heroes, the posters on my wall. I'm a kid with LeBron James on my wall. So I don't want to compare myself to them, but I certainly admire them and I kind of take their lead.
Brian, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Airbnb's got a pretty nice set of offices, by the way. We've got some pictures up at our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a couple of details on the likely demise of the Comcast-Time Warner cable deal. Item number one, Comcast apparently isn't going to have to pay the usual breakup fee, the somewhere between 2 and 5% of the sale price that the would-be acquirer normally pays to the would-be acquiree if things go south. Just wasn't in the original deal, says Fortune magazine. Also, Time Warner Cable CEO Robert Marcus would have gotten an $80 million exit package. That's $80 million if the deal had gone through. Or to look at it another way, more than $1 million a day for the 45 days from when Marcus took over to the day the merger was announced. Now, well, sorry about that, Mr. Marcus. Hey, look at the time. We got to go. The Dow up 20 points today, 10%. The Nasdaq up 20 points, 0.4%, as I said, record high there. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%. John Buckley, Kate Concannon, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shawn, Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.